some guy wrote to me and he says, "Hey, Shepard, why don't you ever mention whatever happened to romantic love? How come nobody has romantic love no more? They don't even mention it no more, and it's as if it never really existed. It's like nobody even knew that it was, much less recognized the fact that it's disappeared. Whatever happened to romantic love, Shepard? I'll bet you don't have the guts to talk about that on your program, you Fink."
"You can get water where there ain't anywhere.
What, Fink?
You can hear ring and where there
signed
ain't
a disgusted ex-listener, a daily newsreader.
You can get
Fink,
money where there ain't any.
You don't know nothing about
you
love, Shepard. Fink,
pain.
Rotten Democrat, Fink.
After the rain, you can often find heaven without going above, but you can't get loving where there ain't any love.
Fink. Rap, Fink. Well, now let me tell you. You know, it's a funny thing about this business of love. The trouble with me is that I learned about love very early. And I learned about it in the crucible itself. Now, it's one thing to learn about love reading novels by Frank Yarby. And maybe reading about stuff that J.D. Salinger writes about. But it's another thing learning about love right in the arena. And it happened to me at a very early age. And I might as well start spilling the beans right now, because there's nothing that America's more hooked on than L-U-V. Love. I'm waiting for somebody to come out and name, just come right out and flatly name a new wash day miracle that. Yes, the new miracle wash day that washes it all out, takes care of it all. Love. Ask for it at your friendly Deitch supermarket. L-U-V, love. And you know what that spells, friends. And you know what that means. Can't you just see the wonderful commercials they can have for that one? Huh? There's a lovely chick, you know. If you've noticed that more and more commercials are not talking about the stuff they sell. They're talking about human emotions. Have you noticed more and more commercials feature little dramas of, you know, mankind in conflict? They're real dramas. For example, well, we all know about the little friendly winemaker. We're waiting for the one day when he falls off that forklift. Tighter than the coot, hits his head on the bucket there, and in falling, he grabs a hold of this chick on the way down. Oh, it's going to be, you know, that'll sell a lot of that wine. Let me tell you, that'll move that stuff off the shelves. Well, you know, it's a funny thing. These commercials are featuring little dramas now. There's one where the chick looks right out. It's a brazen hussy. Looks right out. She's wearing a big hat. And she's talking about this stuff where you take a bath with. She says, "Oh, this is the stuff you take a bath with. It doesn't do stuff like get you clean, let me tell you." And the next thing you know, you hear, yad, 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 and you see this hand. And you see her slowly massaging her foot with the bubbles, see? And now she's worked her way up to her calf, you see? And the next thing you know, the camera's up on her kneecap. And then it's going a little bit higher. Oi, oi, oi. And just before, you know, wow. Oi. It's too bad it's only a 58-second commercial. Holy smokes. Well, I'm telling you, it's fancy. I'll tell you, it's really fancy, Eddie. Fancy. Maji. I'm wishing all I'd Maji. Oh, there, cut it out. And then the chick winds up by peeking out of the edge of the screen, and she says, "It's very expensive, but after all, who deserves the best more than you?" I can see some listless, rotten, decadent 20th century person sitting there saying, "Yeah, me, I deserve the best, nothing but..." Oh, they're getting right down there. Pay dirt. Well, since you want to talk about love, I don't know whether to tell you the story of the great accordion band fiasco. Because, yes, I one time got myself terribly entangled. You've heard about people, you know, about something getting thrown into the fan? Well, it got thrown into the fan. That was, as a matter of fact, it wasn't a fan. It was an accordion band. And I don't know whether to tell that story or not, because I'm sure there are a lot of women and children and kids listening at this hour. Speaking of women and children and kids, we might as well get some of the commercials out of the way here. The kid stuff, Greasy. Here's great news for our newspaper readers. Walter Winchell, for you serious readers, the great New York columnist is back in town. Every weekday for the duration of the newspaper strike, you'll find Walter Winchell of New York in Metropolitan Daily, New York's whoopiest newspaper. You'll find that on sale at your friendly neighborhood news dealer. That's the Metropolitan Daily, your favorite paper. Let's see. Gee, wouldn't it be a gas if... What a, it was, you know, it staggers the imagination, but it's an awful thought. The CBC recently did a profile, a one-hour program about a city without a newspaper, which, of course, New York. And they went all over town, and they asked a lot of people, and it was very interesting to find that the consensus of the people was roughly, eh, who cares? And the people who are really making the big hoopla about the newspapers are the advertisers. The radio stations are talking about it incessantly. They make it sound like, the newspapers really are much more important to apparently the radio stations than the radio stations are ever important to the newspapers. They're just going on endlessly about this thing. And another group that seems to worry about it, of course, is the columnists themselves. They're making various guest appearances all over, telling you we're going to be back and it's going to be more fun than ever. Walter Lippmann is going to be back and he's going to be more profound than ever. All of them, you know, says, for example, I read one that said, who is this columnist now? Oh, Westbrook Pegler is going to be back, and let me tell you, he's storing up a lot of anger. He's going to be even more ridiculous than ever. And they're promising you all these things, and all the people are just walking around scratching. You know, just scratching. Well, wouldn't it be fantastic if the Times comes back and the Herald Trib comes back and nobody buys it? They all buy the Metropolitan Daily? Or keep buying the Village Voice? Or just keep scratching? Speaking of the scratchers, this is WORAM of FM New York, and we're in New York here. In New York, that's it, New York. And we'll be here until the next batch of scores come on, which we're holding in the wings here. And see, I'm the dramatic pause between when you find out what happened to Fordham and when you find out what happened to Seton Hall. I'm that dramatic, long, stretched-out thing. Speaking of dramatic pauses here, we have big news for camera fans from Peerless, Lexington Avenue and 43rd Street. Boiling it all down, Peerless is having a wild sale about love. You know, you learn about love in a myriad of ways. You really do. When we think of love, we always think of love in the sense of, we think of a guy, you know, a chick. We think of Audrey Hepburn. We think of Cary Grant. We think of mother love. Well, there's all kinds of love, Dad, and some of this love, you know, when you get exposed to it very early. I heard a guy the other day on a radio program being interviewed, and he's discussing A Current Turkey that's appearing on Broadway. And, of course, it's guess what the subject is, of course. It's the lack of, L-U-V, you see, this is a big thing. So everybody in the cast is looking for love, continually looking for love. Well, now, okay. Now, that's not so surprising, but it's what the guy said that in a way indicates it. This is an actor, see, and he's talking about it, and he says, of course, the central character of Jamie, who is a 12-year-old or 17-year-old boy, Jamie is very unhappy because he didn't get the proper amount of love and he didn't get the proper amount of attention when he was a young boy. And so, naturally, it finally results in the fact that he kills his mother. Oh, for crying out loud, you know, this came out of the old loudspeaker like a shot out of the head, you know. He finally, well, of course, it naturally results in the fact that he kills his mother. Well, you know, it suddenly hit me. There it was. It was all stated there that everybody's looking for love as though it's something that is going to come to them. And nobody seems to be looking to give it, you know. It's a fascinating thing. They're always looking to get it. And so, in the end, one of my favorite columnists put it the other day to me in a place down in the village. He says, look, Dad, what I'm looking out for is me. Me. And when I find love, it's going to be somebody who loves me. I said, okay, John. And I went back out on 7th Avenue with my eyeballs spinning. And I realized that I'd learned not only something about the attitudes of today, but also about the writers of today. Very interesting problem here. Well, when I'm this kid, see, I'll tell you how I learned about love. One of the wildest, I don't know whether I should tell you the story of the great accordion band fiasco. Do you want me to tell you about the accordion band fiasco? Now, think about it carefully, because this is a sickening story. I'm serious. It's a very sickening story. It's like, you know, it's what gets into the fan. You sure? You want to hear about the great accordion? Oh, all right, then I won't tell you about the accordion. No, you're right, Ed. You're right. You're very right, Ed. Ed said no, he doesn't want to hear about it. And I no accordion band fiasco. All right. Then, do you want to hear about the great Shrewsbury shoe mystery? You want to hear about that one? Well, I'll tell you. This also is related to love. There's a time and a place for everything, friends. I'm certainly glad you vetoed that accordion story. I don't think I'm right yet to approach you that, really. If there's anybody out there wants to hear the accordion story, no, don't call up. No calling up. I just want you to think a clean thought, that's all. I'll get them here. No, don't worry. The clean thoughts come in here. We have a special clean thought receptacle here. And a good clean thought on the part of several of you out in Babylon or Staten Island will come right in here. And if you think them hard enough, I'll get them. All right, I'm listening. Well, I'll tell you about Shrewsbury. About 2 weeks ago, I go through a town named Shrewsbury, New Jersey. Have you ever heard of Shrewsbury, New Jersey? And I felt a very funny pang way down deep inside because of Shrewsbury, New Jersey. Shrewsbury, New Jersey is related to my Army career. Right near Shrewsbury, New Jersey is Fort Monmouth. As a matter of fact, Shrewsbury is on one side of Fort Monmouth. It's at one of the gates of Fort Monmouth. You know this. You've been there? Well, I'm in the Army, see? And for some reason or other, for like about 2 years in the Army, I can't get anybody to fix my shoes. Now, the Army has a shoe repair system where you take your shoes down to the orderly room, you know, down to the supply room, and they take your shoes away and they fix them. Well, it seems that I am in the process of constantly either getting shipped or I have a highly intimidating supply room clerk who every time you come down there and your foot is sticking out of your shoe, he says, oh, get out of here. When the shoes are rotten, we fix them. Now get out, you bum. You know, that kind of thing. Oh, yes, it's the way in the Army. So year after year, I'm wearing the same shoes. And finally, the shoes, by the time I am arrived at Fort Monmouth, which is like 2 years, I'm arrived at Fort Monmouth, the shoes are peopled on the bottom with thousands of little bumps, all of which are sharpened. It was almost like, well, it was like one of these things that these Indian fakirs have, you know, and I was walking around on them all, like, woo, and I had this continually pained expression. So I go down to the supply clerk. Finally, I'm going to do something about it. I go down to the supply clerk. Now, I have to preface this with the thing that a man in the Army, in fact, a man in the office, grows to love the things that are around him. Many a guy literally loves his comptometer machine. It is. It's his companion in arms. It literally is. It's the thing that for some reason or other, it's his thing, you know? You know what I mean by that? It's his little thing. He's got a hold of it, and he punches it, and he makes it. And it's his thing. He plays it like a guy plays his guitar or you know, hits his little machine. And it's the thing by which he not only earns his living, it's the thing that gives him his identity. The minute he goes. No, I'm serious. People do grow to love the things that are part of the tools of their trade, whatever they are. Now, if you're in a situation where there is damn little else to love, you wind up by loving the most ridiculous things. For example, GIs love their shoes. Do you know that? I'm telling you the truth. It was the most common thing of all to come into the barracks at night. You know those pictures, the movies where they always show guys sitting around and writing letters home on their footlocker? Forget it. That is only like the first three months in the Army. If that camera was to come in, like the guys have been in the Army 2 years, you know what you'd see? Not a single guy writing a letter. You'd see a lot of guys throwing letters away. You know, oh, for God's sake. Jeez. And then what you will see about every third bunk, some guy sitting there hunched over his boots. He's going, oh, okay. Oh, look at this baby. Holding up like, oh, lovely. And then he takes clunk, 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 puts it on again. Pat. Takes it off again, holds it up to the light. Oh, you speck of beauty. Look at these. Hey, Mac, look at these. Look at these. Aren't they magnificent? And, of course, all the while, Mac is not looking at anything because he's hung up on his own shoes down there. He happens to be a guy who's hung up on his buckle. He said, the very different kind. And so, hey, Mac, take a look at this. Mac is down there with the blitz clones. With the buckle. It's halfway worn through now. It's been 3.5 years. He's been at Anzio. And the only thing he knows now that sticks with him always is his buckle. And every night he's down in the latrine washing his belt. Yo, yes. Every night you're down there instead of dates. Guys, you know, they've given up now. They just, it's no use anymore. They are pariahs, social pariahs. They don't go down. The old soldiers never go down to the USO. They just don't. And so here you see them. Oh, no, it's too late. You know, how many donuts can you enjoy? I mean, where do you go after the third cup of hot chocolate? And after the fourth junior hostess has said, well, it's time for the bus to leave. Oh, crying out loud. So you give up on that whole world, and you begin to love other things. And so it is the most common thing of all, about 2 o'clock in the morning, to see this old soldier. He's in the latrine now. And what is he doing? It's 2 o'clock in the morning. He's got to get up at 5. Remember this. He's got to get up at 5:15. He's hunched over the wash tub, and he's got a little wire hair brush, and he's got that strong GI soap, and he's going... Then he takes the scalding hot water. He beats it down. What he is doing is he's trying to make his belt snow white. Now, it's originally brown, you see. It takes a guy roughly one hitch to get all the brown stain and all the brown dye finally bleached out of it, and he has a snow-white belt. Then he finally arrives at another place, and they say, hey, soldier, get that white belt off. What are you talking about? Uniform. Get out of your uniform. And then my white belt. Then they make him put another brown one on, and it starts all over again. He's in the latrine that night going, well, this is a kind of love that I'm sure a few of you guys know about, unless you've been there. You know, you know about it, and it's the end of it. Well, I happen to be a shoe man. There were guys that were buckle men. There were guys that were button men, believe me. There were guys who spent all of their time getting their shirts trimmed in at the waist. There were some guys that did nothing but the whole army getting their shirts retrimmed, cut. You know, have you seen those tight shirts, you know? That was another love. They'd hang their shirts up, and you'd see them brushing the collars and all that. I was not that. I never was hung on the shirts. It was the shoes. I was a shoe man. Well, week after week, and finally after a while, you know, I got so that these shoes were the only things that I knew. You arrive in a camp, you know, you don't know anybody. There's your friendly old rotten shoe sitting there under the bunk. And you say, good old shoe. You remember those days at Monmouth? Oh, for crying out loud. You remember Bizarda? And you hit the old shoe on the fanny, good old shoe, and you take it out. And upon this shoe, there has rested the dust of 7 continents. My only friend never lets me down. You brush the thing. Until finally, the shoe, you say, oh, I can tell you a million different ways to polish shoes. A magnificent shoe polisher I became. There's the spit technique. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. There's nothing. Like that. Rub it in until next thing you know the thing glows in the dark. Oh yeah. Well, it takes, see, that was one of the things that you hated about getting new shoes, because a new shoe is like it's almost like a new chick. You know, at first it's an exciting thing to realize you're going to get a new shoe, but after a while it starts to hurt. I mean, it gets you in the ankles and all that stuff, whereas the old one didn't do that. It wasn't exciting, but it didn't do that. You see, you knew where your enemies were with your old shoes, you know. You knew just how to walk so that you could avoid the nail in the lower left-hand corner, you know. And you knew all about this stuff. Well, all right, now you got the picture. I love my shoes. In fact, I love my shoes so much that one day I went down to the orderly room, saying I want to get them fixed, finally. I want these shoes fixed. They're my shoes. So the guy says, nah, the shoe fixing department isn't open until next Wednesday, for crying out loud. Get out of here. Well, I decided for the first time that I was going to do something that guys are always threatening to do in the Army, and that is they're going to take it outside, they call it. Take it outside, see. Well, where was outside, you see, in Monmouth? Outside was, well, there were several outsides. There was Little Silver, you know, of a town named Little Silver. Let me tell you about the time I arrived at Little Silver at 2 o'clock in the morning, and there were about, must have been 150 of us. And one little lousy tiny truck was waiting for us that seated 6 guys. The temperature was like 7 below 0, and the wind was blowing in off the marshes and off of Saugatuck and off of those swamps over there. And we're standing on that platform, and we don't know where we're going. We don't know where we've come from. All we know is we're in trouble. And you can hear the boat going, ooh, waiting out there. And you can hear the shot and shell, and you can almost hear the snipers all the way over there in Little Silver. But that's another story. We'll save that one till later. So outside of the other end of the camp was Shrewsbury. Well, somebody told me in Shrewsbury there was a great shoe repair man. And so one night I take my beloved shoes You have two pair of shoes, you know, in the Army. Both of them are beloved. But for some reason or other, you love usually one pair more than the other. See, love is never equal. It never is. It is. It's a very subtle thing. And I took my most beloved pair of shoes one night into the shoe repair shop at Shrewsbury. Now, it was one of those friendly little shoe repair shops. You know, all shoe repairmen, I think, come out of the same mold or something. They're special national. Now, it's the little short, gray-haired guys. You rarely find a new or a young shoe repairman. They're all little short, gray-haired men who got big, thick thumbs. And they wear these gray coats, you know, that have got black stuff all over them. And they're always sort of short men. What was that? What? Yeah, we can fix. We fix them. Yeah. Fix them. Heels? Yeah. We fix them. Well, so there were two of these little men in there. And I gave them my shoes. Well, I go out. Now, in the window, you could see all the little ladies' high heel shoes, you know. And you could see the men's shoes, the civilian-type shoes. And as far as I could see none of these big clunkers. Two great big fat GI shoes were put in there. Okay, you got the picture. 4 days later, I find myself without a pass. I cannot get out. My shoes are still in the shoe repair shop. It is going to be like 10 days before they're fixed. And I've got this little ticket in my wallet. Well, another week goes by. I get my pass back. I go into this place in Shrewsbury like a shot to get my lovely shoes. I go in there, and the place is closed. It's some Greek holiday or something. I mean, it's closed. There's a sign that's closed next week. We'll be back yet. Well, I you know, what am I going to do? So I go back into the camp. I figure, well, next week I'll get them. So I get my pass yanked again because the outfit I'm in is now alerted. They will not let us out of the gates. I'm wild about my shoes. So about, maybe 2 or 3 weeks later, I finally get out. I arrive 5 minutes after the joint is closed. Well, I don't have to tell you what happened. Finally, one day, I am shipped. My shoes remain in Shrewsbury. There was a big sign in there that said, goods left over 30 days, forget it. And I can never go past Shrewsbury or through Shrewsbury anymore without thinking of this fantastic lost love. I never got these shoes back. And as far as I know, the shoe repair shop does not even exist now. Maybe it does. I don't know. I wonder what would happen if I went back to that place in Shrewsbury and said, you got a pair of GI shoes, 8.5 C? The high ones, the jump boots, please, type. And a little man, he'd say, you? Yeah. And he would scurry back behind his counter, and he would take out this hoary pair of dust-covered, beautifully shined GI shoes. And I could just see the water, the great tears welling up into my eyes. And he'd say, for you, for me. I'd clutch him to my breast. And 10 minutes later, I'm riding the train back to New York. Evangeline, my lost love. As at last. Oh, stop it. So you see, there's all kinds of love. I learned about love. Oh, speaking of love. We have with us tonight the Mandarin House, one of the very few restaurants that really loves you. And I would like to suggest that if you have never tasted or enjoyed Mandarin food, now is about the time to make the scene. Mandarin House, there's two of them, and they are magnificent. Just believe me, they are magnificent. And getting better all the time. There's one on 13th Street between 6th and 7th in the Village. That's Mandarin House proper. And that's spelled with Chinese characters. And then there's one up on 2nd Avenue, just north of 57th Street. This is Mandarin House East. And they are magnificent. If you've never had Mandarin food, I'm very serious about this. If you are hung on the takeout chicken chow mein stuff, be careful. This is not at all the same kind of food. And you must be prepared for something extremely different. This is Mandarin food. It is very, very different from what you call ordinarily Chinese food, which is usually Cantonese. This is Mandarin. 13th Street between 6th and 7th, and one up on 2nd Avenue just north of 57th Street. One point. Please make a reservation. The one on 57th Street is tiny. It's a beautiful, tiny, jewel-like restaurant. So give them a call before you go there. And they both have bars, which makes a lot of them make it. You really want me to tell the story of the accordion band? All right, I will. I'm sorry, Eddie. I've just got to tell you the story because when we arrive up at that great bar of justice up there beyond, you know, there's many a thing that each one of us is going to have to answer for. And I suspect kind of that this is going to be one of the things that I'm going to have to be put down in the ledger for. I'm this kid, see. Now, I'm not really a kid. Remember that. I'm like a 17-year-old kid. And I got this job in this radio station. I'm going to school. Well, every Saturday morning, this radio station had a program called Uncle Elby's Kitty Hour. Actually, Uncle Elby was not on for an hour. Uncle Elby was on for 2 hours. And what Uncle Elby did, roughly, was Uncle Elby held sway over the most insane group of non-talented kids that you ever saw in your life. But they were not only non-talented, they were aggressively non-talented. And more than that, each one was accompanied by a super aggressive, non-talented mother who insisted that her non-talented kid was more talented than all the other non-talented kids, and each one in a loud, screaming voice. Now, what these non-talented kids did was play incredible accordions. They were the kind of accordions that were so big they came in on rollers. You know, the kind that had the kid's name in rhinestones on the side, like Cliffy, you know, on one side, and on the other side, it would say Chucky. And then in the middle, it had notes all over it in rhinestones, that kind of thing. And the kids would buy them for $650 a piece from the nominal Uncle Elby. And Uncle Elby had the accordion school. Now, part of the gimmick for Uncle Elby to get the kids in was that they would all go on the radio, as Uncle Elby said. Yes, kiddies, every one of you kids, if you decide that you would like to play the accordion and become a success at all the parties at school, be loved and admired by all of your companions and by all of your girlfriends and by your teachers and mothers, we'd like to tell you that there is nothing more that will add to the social acceptance of your child than to learn to play a musical instrument. And what musical instrument is the most popular musical instrument for a child to play? Simple and easy to play. The accordion. Yes, the accordion. Full of wonderful melody. The accordion full of wonderful fun. And in just 5 minutes, your child will be playing simple melodies like this. Yes, that was little Johnny Smithson, who just 5 minutes ago signed up for our 14-week course at just $75 a week. He is the proud possessor now of a $695 beautiful chrome-covered, aluminum-covered, magnificently sequined accordion. Would you tell us how you like it, Johnny?
Yeah, it's great.
Well, that's the kind of scene it was. Now, if he got in his clutches a kid who couldn't afford to spring for $695 for the gigantic sequined accordion, he'd get him for the Hawaiian steel guitar, which was only $195 and came complete with a separate and extra set of strings for when he busts them. And it also came with an aluminum pick, it came with a bone pick, and it came with a pick made of solid human skin. Nevertheless, oh yes, and it came with a beautiful case that was suitable for carrying, just like the professional musicians carry. And it has complete with it a plug for an amplifier if in case one day you buy an amplifier and go into a rock and roll band. Well, now that's the kind of scene it was. Well, now what happened was they would have at least 128 kids. It was only a two-hour program. You take off, let's say, 75 minutes for commercials. You had roughly, I'd say, 12 minutes for the kids to blow. Well, and they did. Let me tell you that. So there was great competition as to who was going to play Red Sails in the Sunset every week. Among the mothers, who would all assemble in the studio. All 500 of them. It's amazing, you know. Some of those kids were the result of not only triangles, but pentagons. Some of those kids would come in with five mothers, at least, I swear. And seven fathers. All of them beer-drinking, gin-swigging, tobacco-chewing steel workers. Who were very mad if their kid didn't get down this week. Guess who was in charge of getting the kids on? Oh, I learned about love early, Dad. And so, here was the way the program would go. See, I was the commercial announcer, and Uncle Albie was this jovial hopping about. He kind of looked like, if you can imagine a Pinky Lee who's been drinking and betting on the horses. You know? That kind of a character was. That was Uncle Albie. Well, Uncle Albie had this gigantic kiddies accordion band. And every week, our theme song would come on with 115 kids playing either accordions, at least 75 were accordions, and the rest, another 75, Hawaiian steel guitars. Well, it was a cacophony, believe me, that must have resounded all the way into the ninth inner circle of hell itself. The souls in torment must have stirred at that one. Well, I would come on and I would say, "Yes, it's Uncle Albie time, and time for the accordion band." And the instant that theme would stop, every mother's eyes, like 125 pairs of solid chrome steel ice picks, would be looking at me. "If that louse keeps Herbert off again this week, I'm going to strangle him myself personally. If you don't do it, Catherine, for what he did to Howard last week." And they're all sitting. And behind me is this collection of little monsters, all of them in patent leather shoes, completely covered by enormous accordions. And every once in a while you'd hear, blah, 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 one would fall. And then they'd pick him up. You'd just see these accordion with feet, you know, the fantastic scene. And then you'd hear behind me, boy, oi, 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 oi. Another E string is given up. And I'm in panic. I'm not worrying about the listeners. I'm worrying about Mama. I'm worrying about Daddy. I'm worrying about the whole thing, the whole scene. And then after the program, of course, we would get roughly 7 kids on. After the program, I would duck out the fire escape, down the fire escape with the sound of B-flat accordions in my ears, Hawaiian steel guitars, and I would be 15 minutes later in Flick's Tavern. Witchlitz.
This is WOR Radio.